From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And what a day. There's been some blockbuster testimony today behind closed doors in the impeachment inquiry, the testimony from U.S. Ambassador to the EU, Gordon Sondland. In prepared remarks, Sondland told lawmakers that it was President Trump who told him and other diplomats to work with his personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, on Ukraine diplomacy. Sondland says that Giuliani then told him that Ukraine should investigate the 2016 election as well as corruption at a Ukrainian natural gas firm. Now, Sondland claims that at the time he did not know that then-Vice President Joe Biden's son served on the board of that gas firm. And Sondland notes that he did call Trump after a State Department official questioned if there were any quid pro quos to get Ukraine to cooperate with Giuliani. Sondland said that Trump was in a bad mood when he called to ask if there were. There's also much turmoil today over Trump's Syria policy, so let's bring in NPR's diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman. Hi, Michelle.
Hi there, Robin.
And staying with Sondland, he paints a picture of officials reluctantly going along with Trump's request to involve Giuliani, a citizen, and they had discomfort with Giuliani's agenda. How does that square with the other testimony we've been hearing about this week?
Well, we've been hearing from other career diplomats who certainly had a lot of misgivings about what Giuliani was up to, but who also saw Sondland as part of that kind of parallel foreign policy going on. In his testimony, Sondland insists that he was coordinating with the State Department. In fact, he said that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo gave him his blessing and sent him a congratulatory note encouraging him to, quote, keep on banging away. As for his dealings with Giuliani, he says it was at a White House meeting on May 23rd. He was there along with the U.S. envoy on Ukraine at the time, Kurt Volker. They were just back from Volodymyr Zelensky's inauguration as Ukraine's new president, and they wanted Trump to call him. But according to Sondland, Trump was skeptical about the new Ukrainian president and directed them to talk to Giuliani first. As Sondland says, it was apparent to all of us that the key to changing the president's mind was Giuliani.
Well, talk about the phone call that Sondland made to President Trump. And this was after these text messages he exchanged with acting Ukrainian Ambassador William Taylor, in which Taylor says he thinks it's crazy to withhold military assistance in exchange for help with a political campaign. In other words, he read it, as many have, that this was a quid pro quo, that the president had put a hold on monies for Ukraine to help defend themselves against Russians on the border. For help with investigating Joe Biden and his son. Talk more about what Sondland says about that phone call he made to President Trump before responding to Taylor.
Right. So he says that, for one, that he supported the security assistance to Ukraine and that, you know, he understood that Taylor was really worried about this perception of a quid pro quo. He says he called Trump directly and he asked, what do you want from Ukraine? The president, he says, said nothing. There's no quid pro quo, and repeated that multiple times. Sondland, as you mentioned, says that the president was in a bad mood at the time. So that's pretty much all he said. He didn't say whether, at least in the written testimony, whether he believed that there was no quid pro quo.
But, you know, there still must be questions because he didn't say in his text to Taylor, I asked the president and he said there was no quid pro quo. He said in his text, I think you're wrong. There was no quid pro quo. He made it his opinion.
Right. And the committees are really going to want to pin him down on this about what he believed at the time and also what he was hearing from the Ukrainians. You know, diplomats that I've spoken to say the Ukrainians were very confused during this time. They heard a lot of different things from Americans. And some were clearly believed that the delay in security aid was tied to Trump's desire to open up investigations that could be helpful for Trump politically.
In the minute that we have, what's the tone there, given that we also have Republican lawmakers furious at President Trump for the withdrawal from Syria? We have these two stories running parallel. What are you hearing?
Well, I think career ambassadors, at least, are in a kind of a pretty bad spot at the moment. And you heard a little bit of that in yesterday's testimony. Mike McKinley, a 37-year veteran of the State Department who resigned last week, told the committee that you know, he left the State Department for two main reasons. One was the failure of the State Department to offer support to Foreign Service officers caught up in this impeachment inquiry on Ukraine. And second, by what appears to be, and these were his words, the utilization of our ambassadors overseas to advance domestic political objectives. You know, State Department people pride themselves on being nonpartisan. They work with both Republicans and Democrats, and they really work hard on that. And even today, the chief of staff of President Trump was saying he thinks that career diplomats are just don't like Trump's politics, and that's why they're complaining. So there's a lot of tension here.
Sure is. NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman, thank you.
Sure thing.
United Auto Workers union leaders are looking more closely today at a tentative agreement they reached with General Motors. The deal comes as workers have been off the job for just over a month, and GM has racked up losses of more than $1 billion. But the strike is not over yet. The agreement still needs to be ratified by the 46,000 striking workers. And joining us now for the latest and the impact this contract could have for U.S. workers overall is the Detroit Free Press automotive reporter Phoebe Wall Howard. She's in Detroit. Welcome, Phoebe.
Thank you.
Phoebe, it seems that over the last few weeks, UAW and GM were really far apart on a number of the sticking points. What do we know about what's in the contract the UAW leaders will be looking over today?
Details have been leaked, and they're leaking slowly. We're looking at possibly 9,000 jobs rather than 5,400, new or retained. We don't know the location in specific states until that's finalized. We're looking at Detroit Hamtramck Assembly remaining open. Early reports say the deal does not include production at Lordstown, Ohio, so we'll see what happens there. We're looking at increases in wages and a lump sum payment, probably 3-4% based on information, a ratification bonus of at least $9,000. There's tremendous incentive to get workers to ratify the deal and move forward and come off strike. Striking continues until a deal is done.
You've been on the picket lines for several weeks now. What's been the mood from workers so far on this potential deal?
Initially, people were happy and they were focused. And then as things drags on, the anxiety grows. What you have is you have people delivering food. You have people devoting entire paychecks, $275 a week now, to buying diapers and delivering diapers to the different union halls, because many of the temporary workers and people hit hardest who could not save up and prepare for a strike are young families with children. And temporary workers are those who work for years with temporary status and limited benefits and no security. On the picket line, strike sites all around different plants. It's cold, it's rainy. They have 55-gallon drums filled with wood. Tremendous smoke. It actually stings your eyes as the wind blows. People are out with signs, the honking. A lot of people deliver food. Small businesses are delivering hundreds and thousands of sandwiches and pizzas, and people taking it upon themselves to pay as individuals. So the other thing we're hearing on the strike line is folks are helping the workers because they see strong union pay as directly affecting communities and their schools and the tax base. That's not something I expected to hear in interviews, and it came up again and again, that good wages are more than just the individual, but go to a healthy community. And that's why people really want strong, what they perceive to be livable wages.
You've reported that the UAW's ability to get better protections for temporary workers could actually serve as a new framework for the U.S. and other automotive companies like Ford and Fiat Chrysler, but even other industries. Was that issue taken up, or have you heard about the issue around those protections for temporary workers being in this contract?
The UAW represents automakers, and that's what it's known for, but it has tremendous representation nationwide in engineering, aerospace, and research in our universities on the East and West Coasts primarily. So everyone is watching this contract specifically as a model, as a template. So this is about temporary workers. This is about healthcare coverage and how wages will be negotiated. But we understand from tech leaders in Silicon Valley that this negotiation is being watched as a model. They're monitoring the situation in Detroit to see how things are handled.
What's next? What should we be paying attention talked to in the following days.
While workers are optimistic, they're very, very cautious. Workers said to me they're willing to stay out till Thanksgiving. They're willing to stay out until Christmas. They will do without to get it right. They feel like recent contracts have not been, in their words, fair. That workers gave things away to make this company healthy again. And now that the company is thriving, the workers really want what they perceive to be fair wages and protected health care. So in coming days, and I would say the next 2 to 3 weeks, many, many meetings behind closed doors, people will be going over the detail and voting to see if, in fact, this will move forward.
Thank you so much, Phoebe Wall Howard, Detroit Free Press automotive reporter. Thanks for this update.
Thank you.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
And now I am going to get the attention of just about every teen within hearing distance. Watch this. Author John Green is here. Okay, now we got them. For everyone else, The New Yorker called John Green the teen whisperer because of books like Looking for Alaska, An Abundance of Catherines, and of course, The Fault in Our Stars, which became the hit 2014 film about a young girl dying of cancer. John and his brother Hank have wildly popular YouTube channels and legions of fans who call themselves nerd fighters. Don't forget to be awesome. And now they are eagerly awaiting the new limited Hulu series version of John's 2005 book, Looking for Alaska. So enter Josh Schwartz with his partner Stephanie Savage. They have created programs that are in the rock firmament for teens. They include The OC and Gossip Girl. And he and Stephanie have brought John's book to the screen. It premieres tomorrow on Hulu. Here's advance notice. It is great. And both John and Josh join us from NPR West. John Green, are you there?
I'm here. Hi.
Hi. Nice to speak with you again. And co-executive producer, showrunner Josh Schwartz, welcome to you as well.
Thank you so much.
John Green, I have to start with you. First of all, how do you feel about the Hulu version?
Oh, so thrilled. It's just such a moving expansion of the story. I could never have imagined back when I published the book in 2005 that one day there would even be such a thing as a Hulu limited series, let alone that one so wonderful would be devoted to that little story.
Well, let's bring people in. It's a story of Miles Halter, an awkward teen who moves from his home in Florida to a boarding school in Alabama, where there will be a terrible car crash. We see that right at the start. Josh Schwartz, Vulture's rave review says your show expands on the other characters, and they also note the unmistakable, nostalgic Stephanie Savage, Josh Schwartziness of it. What does that mean to you?
I don't know. I've always wanted to be a Ness, so I feel like that's a win in some way. I mean, you know, I was fortunate enough to get a copy of John's book. I believe when it was unpublished, I got it in galley form. It was his first book, so I had not yet heard of him and fell in love with the book right away and with those characters. And it's been a 14-year labor of love to try to get the movie made initially and then eventually migrating it to being a limited series at Hulu. When I first got the book, we were in the middle of The OC and wanted to set the book in 2005, which is the year it was published. And so I think it just links it inextricably to that time when we were making The OC as well.
Well, teens in 2005 who may be watching The OC.
There may be a moment where a couple of our characters might be watching an episode.
Right, right. And let's tell people a little more about this plot. Charlie Plummer plays Miles Halter, not that comfortable in his own skin, although an expert in famous people's last words. He's constantly quoting the very last words of everyone from JFK to
Millard Fillmore.
Yeah.
Yeah, he knows them all. He knows all the major ones. I wanted him to memorize famous last words because I wanted him to have this pat and overly simplistic way of thinking about death at the beginning of the book and in the way that he thinks about the role that death plays in human lives. And then he has to grapple with the reality that death is full of ambiguity. It's full of failure. It's full of guilt. And these simple stories of last words, while they're very narratively compelling and fun, often just aren't the whole truth.
We want to hear a little of the new show, but how much of the book was autobiographical? You've talked about the fact that you did go to a boarding school and you did, you know, there were some pranks there that happened. Somebody did die, not somebody close to you. How much of Miles is you?
Well, there's definitely some of me in Miles, but also there's some of me in Alaska, the main female character in the book, in the sense that when I was in high school, I struggled a lot with self-destructive impulses and felt really profoundly separated, struggled with major depression and stuff like that. The setting of the book is drawn very closely from the setting of The Amazing Place where I went to high school. But the story is very much a novel.
Okay. Well, the school in the book is strictly divided between kids who board and the kids who are rather wealthy who go home on the weekends. Miles' friends include his roommate Chip, called the Colonel, Alaska, as you mentioned, kind of a wild child. And in their very first meeting all together, Alaska and Chip are, you know, reuniting after the summer. Miles is seeing the whole thing for the first time. She is telling a story to Chip about something that happened to her. By grabbing Miles' hand and putting it on her breast, he, of course, freezes in disbelief. It's day one, and he's touching a girl. Let's listen.
Who's this guy not laughing at my story?
My roommate, Miles to Go Halter, a.k.a. Pudge. Pudge memorizes people's last words. He also has money for his cigarettes. Pudge, this is Alaska. She got her boob honked this summer, which you are now well aware.
So that's the story she was illustrating. Christine Froseth plays Alaska. Joe Schwartz, the colonel, this is again the roommate, played by Denny Love, an African-American, which he's not in the book.
We felt that making the colonel African-American would not fundamentally change the story, but potentially open it up. It kind of informs some of the tension between him and those weekday warriors. For them, it's about class. For the colonel, it's about race, or in the fact that in Alabama, sometimes it feels like those two things are the same. And most importantly, it gave us the chance to cast Denny Love, who is fantastic in the show and I think really announces himself. It's really the first big thing that he has done, and his passion for it comes through in every scene.
I want to listen to another scene. This is Miles, Pudge, and Alaska. They're hanging out at a spot where kids sneak away to smoke.
Have you read all the books in your room?
God, no. But I'm going to read them all. I call it my life's library. Every summer since I was little, I would go to all the garage sales and I'd buy all the books that looked interesting. Just so I would always have something to read. But there's so much to do, you know? I'll have more time for reading when I'm old and boring.
Hard to imagine you'd ever be boring.
John, I want to ask you first, then Josh. It's just so real. And John, you know you've got some sort of a pipeline to how young people talk. What is that for you? I mean, what is your affection for young people?
What always has interested me is the feelings. You know, when you're a teenager, you're really asking the big questions about meaning and about justice and about what we owe ourselves and each other for the first time separate from your parents or from your family. And because those questions are new, you're asking them with an enthusiasm and without any kind of ironic distance. And that's really appealing to me.
Yeah. Josh, you and Stephanie also obviously have your finger on the pulse of something, or maybe it's your own pulse. I mean, is part of being able to do this kind of thing and have it resonate so much with young people that you're not trying to listen to teenagers, you're just remembering yourself?
There's definitely a part of that. I mean, it's a time in my life, and I know Stephanie feels the same, that's just so vivid to us. And I think as much as technology changes or slang changes, the emotions, as John was saying, are universal and timeless. And I think that's what we're really interested in capturing. And also when you make something for a young audience, the things that you love when you're in high school, the movies that you love, the TV shows you love, the music that you listen to, you love those things in a way that you will never love anything else again, and in a way that you will never love anything else again. And so for us, it's also really rewarding to make things for an audience that is that passionate about what you're doing.
Do you think there will be a Looking for Alaska sequel?
No.
Okay. Well,
yeah, we were very, because that is the trend with these limited series. It's a limited series, and then you find out, but there's also season two. And we talked a lot, John and Stephanie and I, a lot about we want to tell this story and we want to tell it the best that we can. And very definitively at the end, not spoiling anything, it says the end.
There you go. Well, so John Green, just one last thought, because look, we've been, you know, alluding to it, but there is a death that these characters grapple with. Do you ever worry when you bring up a topic that it will get romanticized? And 13 Reasons Why, which was about suicide, there was a lot of concern and criticism that it might encourage kids, to find fame that way. I mean, did you worry about this death making it to a screen?
I definitely worried about it. And I think Stephanie and Josh and everyone involved have worried about it a lot and have worked really hard to be very careful in how we talk about this and how it's portrayed in the show and also how it's portrayed in the book. I mean, this is a book, I hope, that is about the catastrophic failures that can ensue when people fail to treat other people as humans. And our responsibility to each other is to try to find ways to imagine each other complexly. And as part of that, when we were talking about how to do the show responsibly, we talked a lot about making sure that this doesn't further that old lie that somehow harming yourself is a way to achieve your goals. As someone who's lived for most of my adult life with serious mental illness, I feel like I can say with some authority that there is hope. Even when your brain tells you there isn't, there is hope. And I encourage people who need help to get it today.
Hmm. Well, and I encourage adults also to pick up this book and watch this show. The show is Looking for Alaska, based on the book of the same name by John Green. And it's being brought to Hulu by Josh Schwartz and his producing partner, Stephanie Savage. John and Josh, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And the soundtrack for Looking for Alaska is also getting raves. This song, An Honest Mistake by Mating Ritual, featuring Lizzie Land.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Friends and colleagues are remembering Democratic Congressman Elijah E. Cummings, who died early this morning. A Baltimore mainstay and vocal critic of the Trump administration, Cummings served as the chairman of the House Oversight and Reform Committee. At a hearing for President Trump's former personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, in February, Cummings said this about integrity.
When we're dancing with the angels, the question will be asked, in 2019, what did we do to make sure we kept our democracy intact? Did we stand on the sidelines and say nothing?
I spoke this morning with Eleanor Holmes Norton, who represents the District of Columbia in Congress, who knew Cummings for decades, about her thoughts on his unexpected passing.
My thoughts today are, of course, with his family, but rise above that to what a terrible time to lose Elijah. We are in the midst of impeachment hearings. Our committee, Oversight and Government Reform, is, as I speak, one of the three committees hearing closed testimony as part of the impeachment inquiry. Just last week, he had a conference call with members of the Oversight Committee and gave us every reason to believe that he was doing well. That's why this is such a shockingly sad day for the Congress of the United States today.
And he had weathered many storms. Of course, he was a very vocal Trump critic, but also the Freddie Gray riots, even Rocks and Bottles trying to integrate a whites-only pool as a kid. What would Congressman Cummings want us to remember, to take from his life and his legacy?
Well, I wouldn't dare to say, but I can tell you that for many of us, it's been a life of service and sacrifice. Yes, he grew up in segregated Baltimore, just down the road from what was then segregated D.C., so we have a special kinship. Elijah went to Howard University. He was chairing the Oversight and Government Reform Committee at a time when the district is seeking to become the 51st state. I'm so sorry he didn't live to see this bill pass the Congress, as it will, given all the efforts he's put into this specific issue.
You are headed into the impeachment inquiry, as you mentioned. This is a major loss for the country. But can you talk a little bit more as you step into those inquiries, the loss of him and what that means for you all as you're moving forward with this investigation?
Well, Elijah's leadership would be especially needed today because he enjoyed rare bipartisanship in what has been, I think all agree, one of the most polarized Congresses in American history. He is just the kind of commanding figure we need to remind both sides of not only the seriousness, but of the fact we cannot and must not forget that we are one Congress and we are one nation. There are few leaders in this Congress with that stature who could bring that kind of spirit to what the Congress is going through today with the impeachment inquiry and all that that entails for the country.
Eleanor Holmes Norton, she represents Washington, D.C. in Congress. Thank you.
Of course.
This morning, we paid a visit to some fellow Americans.
And that's the way we love it. All talk, no action. Hey, welcome aboard. I'm Charlie Stone, Jeff on the other side of the window, and you found open line.
This was a return visit to Charlie Stone's popular and very conservative talk show, Open Line, on KSCJ in Sioux City, Iowa. In this moment, an impeachment inquiry heating up anger, especially from Republican lawmakers like Lindsey Graham, over President Trump's abandonment of the Kurds in Syria, we wondered, what were these fierce Trump supporters thinking? We'll post our whole visit at hereandnow.org, but essentially, they, the listeners, corrected me on what they thought was my misinterpretation of the news. I did the same, but we were both civil, and they were upset. These are Americans who think that their president is under attack. Their vote is being discounted. Let's start with host Charlie Stone.
When this impeachment thing came up, I said, from the day he came down the escalator, there has been stuff thrown at him constantly. And we are in the middle of Trump territory, as you well know,
Robin.
And I said, this particular one bothers me because this is a bone that the people that are anti-Trump can really chomp onto. Now, having said that, over the last few months, people of that I know of have sort of just stopped arguing. They are Trumpsters. They will vote for him again. And they are done and frustrated with trying to talk to those on the other side who they feel, and I somewhat agree, are making things up out of whole cloth. The quid pro quo implication of using his office to influence a foreign nation. Part of the president's job, and we all know it, was in the 2016 election, there was, I think even you would agree, some hanky-panky going on from global influences.
I would agree. The Russians absolutely interfered in the election.
Yeah, absolutely. And it probably will be again in 2020.
You know, I would ask you to go back to the writing in 2016, to the reporting before anybody... As I said, we respectfully exchange viewpoints, but these listeners were extremely skeptical even of facts like the transcript of the president's phone call to the Ukrainian president that launched the impeachment inquiry. Here's a caller who called himself Yeoman.
What the trend, what people, a lot of neighbors, friends, people think out here on the whole impeachment, that is a fiasco by the deep state to take out a duly elected president. Whether you like Trump, whether you love him or hate him, it is the deep state that is not happy that he won, that absolutely had the deck stacked to where Hillary was going to win. They couldn't believe that they are, that their systems failed, and that the flyover, the people spoke and said, "No, we want somebody that's not a politician for a change."
Syria, okay. how do you feel about the pullout in Syria?
Absolutely. Great. Absolutely. We have no business over there. Mm. That's one thing that Trump was elected to do, was get us out of the endless wars. 18 years in Afghanistan. Yeah. The most powerful force, the most powerful part of that deep state, and they're all in bed with each other. Part of that is the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned us against when he gave his farewell address. And isn't it amazing how the Democratic Party, which used to be, oh, we're against war, and now Trump wants to take us out, and all of a sudden, oh, they're all for staying in that war.
Let me just jump in. I hear everything you're saying. Some would say that, you know, the war in Iraq, based on false information about weapons of mass destruction, was appalling. But in this case, there's just so many different questions. First of all, a unilateral decision to pull out, not telling even the Pentagon. A decision based on a phone call with an autocrat in Turkey. A decision when U.S. troops, yes, they are precious, and they're still there. And now we have Turkey invading. What if U.S. troops get in the middle of that? And then the last point, these are the Kurds who fought ISIS. Any loss of life is horrendous. We did lose some troops there, but our troops, mainly in combat there, they were backing up the Kurds who were doing... The Kurds lost 10,000 fighters taking down ISIS. I don't know. My dad was a Marine. I think he's rolling, you know, right now. We talked with listeners for over a half hour. Here's a little more of the voices of Sioux City, Iowa.
All due respect, Robin. Thank you for calling. We're from Iowa. We voted for Trump. Our president was elected. We resent accusations being made without facts. Until the real facts come out and there's proof of anything, we will continue to stand by this man.
The reason that we voted for Trump, my wife and I, is that this man fights back. He doesn't back down. And we love that, especially talking to the media. And the media was trying to destroy Trump, but it's not happening because he fights back.
Yeah.
And the media doesn't know what to do. They never had a person like this before stand up to them. And we're cheering him on. And every day that the media attacks him, we cheer him on even more.
Well, Greg, let me ask you something. For people who people on the East Coast have seen him a lot in the past through the media and everything, and he was thought of as being, you know, crass. And then we saw that with the tapes that emerged when he talked about women's body parts. And, you know, we see in the Mueller report, he wrote a lie, you know, he dictated a lie to explain why his son had the meeting in the Trump Tower. There are people who can't wrap their brains around, okay, you might like what's happening with the economy, you might like the toughness, but there's a crassness that doesn't square with their vision of Iowa, you know, and the Midwest values, and they can't, they have a hard time squaring that. Can you explain that?
I'll try. Is Trump a perfect person, though? Does he have some issues that maybe in his personality that a lot of people that rubs him the wrong way? Probably. But the fact, as a president representing the vast majority of our values, he doesn't back down. And there's other things, almost insignificant. I don't care to a certain point.
Mm-hmm.
He supports pro-life, which is my biggest thing, and he stands up and fights back on that.
Mm-hmm.
He supports cutting taxes, which is another big thing. He supports having a strong military. These things are monstrous in terms of what we want. The man can be crass, but he's crass in the way that we love it We love it.
Let me throw this on top of it, and asking for Greg and for me, Robin, since when did it become a problem because you're not presidential, in quotes? Because that's what he's not acting presidential. I'm not sure what presidential, in quotes, means. Does it mean you don't use four-letter words? Does it mean you don't get in the face? Does it mean don't get direct?
It means you want your 8-year-old son to admire it. I think that's what it means.
There's a time and place. You know, we feel that President Trump is the last person that's going to help us maintain the country, and civilly being nice to each other, that's going out the door. Mm. That's going out the door right now.
I hear you.
We're ready to fight.
All right, Greg,
thank
you. I gotta hold you there.
Charlie, I have to say to you, I so appreciate this time. I know you probably have what are those things you call them in broadcast? Commercial radio?
Oh,
commercials or something?
Vicious, ugly profiteering.
Well,
profiteering.
I just want to say, last time we talked, it was when Steve King, your rep there, was removed by the GOP House leaders because he made comments about white supremacy.
Mm-hmm.
And I just have to say, your listeners were also wonderful and expressive, and I appreciated them then as well. And afterwards, we got a whole bunch of things, including a letter from one Ann in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, who said, hey, please accept this gift from an Iowan who's not in King's 4th District. And I'm holding it up. I don't know why I'm holding it up because we're on radio. It's a T-shirt that says, Dear America, sorry about Steve King. Sincerely, Iowa.
That's beautiful.
So we recognize Iowa's a big state with a lot of big thoughts.
He's back in a run for his life on that.
Hear you. I think the Democrat and the Republican, Feenstra and Shulton, are both outraising him, I think. So, hey, Charlie, I hope we can talk again.
Please.
I appreciate it. So,
you're more than welcome.
Thanks, Charlie.
We can teach you the right way.
Charlie, thank you.
See you later, Robin.
Bye. An edited version of our visit with Charlie Stone in his Open Line radio show on KSCJ in Sioux City, Iowa. As he said, listeners who lean decidedly to the right will post our full talk at hearnow.org, in which you'll hear more of my responses, but this was a chance to hear their thoughts. It's Here Now.
An Army depot in Colorado is home to a deadly legacy. Hundreds of thousands of chemical weapons have been in storage for decades. They must be destroyed under an international treaty, but environmental concerns have delayed that until now. The shell and mortars there, filled with mustard gas, are finally disappearing. Michael DeJoanna from member station KUNC reports.
During World War II, the U.S. military assembled a special group of soldiers who were preparing to use chemical weapons if the Nazis used them first.
When the gas warfare phase comes, it will produce tremendous casualties on the enemy and at the same time prevent excessive casualties to our own troops.
The film highlights a vast network of chemical weapons labs and manufacturing arsenals working on the efforts.
Here on the outskirts of Denver, Colorado, is the newest of our arsenals, the Rocky Mountain Chemical Warfare Arsenal. It is located completely out of the range of any possible air threat.
The weapons made in this era and subsequent years were sent to various depots around the country, including one about 100 miles south of Denver. The Army's Pueblo Chemical Depot, where they've sat for about 7 decades. By international treaty, workers are disassembling 780,000 shells and mortars.
There's chemical agent in there, there's decontamination solution in there, a vapor hazard, a liquid hazard.
It'll kill you.
That's Tom Bailey. He's a support specialist at the heavily guarded Pueblo Chemical Agent Destruction Pilot Plant, one of just 2 Army sites in the U.S. contending with such chemical weapons. The work is so technical and dangerous that I'm not allowed into the actual site. So I'm visiting a nearby training facility, a life-sized replica. Only there's no mustard agent to worry about here. Inside, there are 2 robots. They're named for characters in the classic 1970s Mel Brooks film, Young Frankenstein. One is Inga, and...
Who was Inga's assistant with Young Dr. Frankenstein?
Well, I'm thinking Igor, or is it Igor?
Igor. You nailed it.
Igor and Inga work together. One cuts open the tops of the shells to remove the bursters that would make them explode. And then comes the tricky part. Some shells are corroded on the inside, and as a byproduct, hydrogen gas can mingle with the mustard agent, causing a deadly hazard.
It's in the liquid.
Okay.
Just like champagne.
Wow.
Okay? What happens when you open a champagne bottle? What happens when you break that seal at the top? Right?
Yeah.
All those bubbles break.
Right.
And when they do, then that...
cascades out.
It expands.
Igor delicately moves a roughly 100-pound shell upside down at a kind of sink. It's a precaution in case the gallon of liquid inside were to start bubbling. A machine sprays high-pressure hot water into the shell, coaxing what's left in it out. The rest of the shell goes to an oven, where it is superheated, burning off any remaining mustard. From there, the steel is recycled, and the liquid flows down a drain through titanium pipes in a closed system. From there...
It is just basic wastewater treatment 101.
Site project manager Walton Levi, who runs the plant, says the water starts to break down the mustard agent and eventually it goes to a reactor where it is neutralized. It becomes what's called thiodiglycol. And as odd as this sounds, the same kind of microbes that are used in sewage systems to consume human waste also eat this stuff.
What is the byproduct of that?
It is mostly water and salt.
Plain old salt.
It's kind of a wet salt.
The water is then pressed out of that salt and reused at the plant. The salt cakes that are left are contaminated with heavy metals.
So you'll see these salt cakes go off to hazardous waste landfill.
By law, the facility's entire inventory, 780,000 shells, must be destroyed by the end of 2023. Levi wants that to happen a full year ahead of the deadline.
We want to make sure we target early as a contingency.
Because there can be delays. Earlier this year, plant operations were halted when two large tanks that store the thiodiglycol developed leaks.
They were down about 3 to 4 weeks.
On July 31st, the plant hit a milestone, processing 150,000 of the largest shells at a rate of 24 per hour as agreed to with the state. All of this effort was created a generation ago as an alternative to how the Army used to destroy chemical weapons, first by dropping them into the sea and, when that fell under scrutiny, by incinerating them at installations. When the work at Pueblo's Army Depot and another depot in Kentucky is finally done, the United States will be rid of its chemical weapons. They were manufactured for a nightmare battle that never happened. For Here and Now, I'm Michael DeOanna.
And Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.